I next met with Dr. Douglas Smith. To begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
I had an interesting case of a young woman, 46 years old, with relatively good health, presented with fatigue and some fevers for a couple of weeks, didn't know what was really going on, and discovered to have a white count of 86,000. Her peripheral blood showed blasts, and obviously anemic and thrombocytopenic went with it. And she presented so with a high white count leukemia. Evaluation included cytogenetics, which showed a normal karyotype, 46XX. But interestingly, her molecular panel showed a FLT3 ITD mutation.
So what were your thoughts about her initial management?
Well, we're getting really good at picking out these FLT3 mutated leukemias because of their presentation, often monocytic, often high white count leukemias, and you know, they can be pretty abrupt in presentation. We don't get lots of these people that are lingering for long periods of time. So ultimately, we're guessing at the time she presents with a normal karyotype that this molecular panel might be real for her. One of the things that's been really important in the FLT3 world is this idea that there are some mutations of FLT3 which probably have a lot of prognostic importance and others that don't have as much prognostic importance. And there are low allelic burdens of FLT3 and high allelic burdens. So, you know, it turns out that our patient had a high allelic burden, really suggesting that the disease was being driven by the FLT3 and that this was going to carry a very poor prognosis for her clinically.
So how did you treat her?
Well, she was induced with traditional chemotherapy, Ara-C-based chemotherapy. And in our program, we decided to add a FLT3 inhibitor. So one of the drugs that's available, sorafenib, it's a drug that's approved for treatment of kidney cancer, has a lot of FLT3 activity. So our clinical trial, in-house clinical trial, is to induce people with Ara-C-based chemotherapy, then proceed to give them a FLT3 inhibitor when possible. Interestingly, at ASH this year, one of the plenary sessions, a really important session, was really talking about this. Now, our study, like the study presented by Rich Stone at ASH this year, added a FLT3 inhibitor to traditional chemotherapy and sort of followed the paradigm that these are high-risk patients. Once in remission, one should consider an allogeneic stem cell transplant as the definitive therapy. And the question really was, what's the role of additional drugs to block FLT3 in the induction and in the sort of maintenance strategies following a transplant? And for the first time, we saw a really nice study, a large study, randomized trial, intergroup study, looking at midostaurin, one of the FLT3 inhibitors that was combined with chemotherapy as well as maintenance strategy and transplant. And we're starting to see some benefit in a large study for adding FLT3 inhibitors to traditional chemotherapy as well as following transplant and a maintenance strategy.
So I'd like you to kind of go through those data a little bit more. Also, the prior data that had come out at the prior ASH meeting about sorafenib, as well as other FLT3 inhibitors. But before you do, could you just bring us up to date on what happened to this patient?
So this patient actually did agree to participate in the trial, achieved a remission. That's expected. You know, we're pretty good with traditional chemotherapy getting these people in remission. The mutation really impacts the quality and the duration of that remission, so people are expected to relapse. She was young, healthy, had a donor, went to an allogeneic stem cell transplant. She's being maintained currently on sorafenib after the transplant as part of our clinical trial, and actually doing well about a year and a half, almost 2 years now from her stem cell transplant. You know, FLT3 has been this really phenomenally interesting and important target for AML, and that's because, number one, we can measure it. Number two, it offers prognostic implications. And number three, there's been a handful of drugs designed really to target it to see if we can improve things.
Just to finish out on her, I'm curious how she's tolerated the sorafenib. Obviously, there's a lot of experience with solid tumors. This is a different situation. What issues, if any, has she had with the sorafenib?
Sorafenib is not well tolerated by everybody. And the clinical trial that we have allows variance in dosing. Our goal is to get 400 milligrams twice a day into these patients. She's actually on 200 milligrams twice a day. GI toxicity, skin rashes, and mucocutaneous irritation from the drug are common. One of the interesting things we saw with her, which is again another common side effect of sorafenib, is hypertension. So she was a pretty healthy young woman, but she now is on drugs to sort of maintain a blood pressure. I think the sorafenib caused her to have high blood pressure, and that's sort of known to be one of the effects of the drug.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, she's been on a year and a half. That's a long time. And, you know, one of the things that we've heard, and I was talking recently with Dan George from Duke about this, is that I started hearing it in thyroid originally, but people have been on a long time, is think about muscle wasting. And I don't know, do you see that? Did you see that in her? He talked about, and I've heard other people talk about, proactively having patients exercise to counteract that.
Yeah, so we're lucky with her. We haven't seen it. I'm more commonly seeing that in higher doses. So when we were using sorafenib in patients that couldn't get a transplant because of their age or some medical comorbidity, and we were using this to maintain them, we definitely did see more of the atrophy or the muscle wasting syndrome. She's on 200 twice a day. She seems to be tolerating it reasonably well. Biochemically, she's doing pretty well. We'd had her on 400 milligrams twice a day prior, and it was some fatigue and much more GI toxicity with that.
If someone were to ask you whether, you know, it would be rational, reasonable, or even you would encourage somebody to actually use sorafenib in the way you've used it outside a trial setting, how would you answer?
The answer is, I believe we're now at the point where patients with high allelic ratio FLT3 ITD mutations in remission seem to be benefiting from FLT3 inhibition. And I do, when primary docs say, hey, my patient lives 4 hours from here, we can't get her there every month for a supply of drug, we are able to get insurance companies to help cover the cost because of the effectiveness of it and the clinical trials that show it works.
In terms of the FLT3 inhibitors and the research that we have out there, maybe you can kind of go through it. So first of all, you have the issue of the initial study. Maybe there were more studies with sorafenib. Then, as you say, at the last ASH meeting, the big plenary presentation of Midostaurin by Rich Stone, maybe you can go through what we know, particularly in terms of efficacy, and efficacy also with people without FLT3 mutations, because I know originally there was a sorafenib study, they showed the benefit was the same, and that was a little confusing. So how do you put it all together?
Oh, I don't know that I can do it that well or do it justice. But, you know, again, this promising target, prognostically important, we have drugs that can hit it. And what we've learned through the years is there's been nearly a dozen, probably 8 or 9 FLT3 inhibitors that have been developed by drug companies targeting mutations. And through our traditional drug development paradigm, they do them as a single agent, refractory patients. And as we've been able to narrow the different tyrosine kinases that these agents hit, we found that these drugs can work through different mechanisms of action, not necessarily killing the FLT3 cells, but actually differentiating the cells and maturing them so that these cells end up causing remissions, but they don't result in full count recovery or permanent remissions. So this ASP2215, this is a FLT3 inhibitor that has a pretty significant single agent activity. It's been looked at in both refractory patients, relapsed patients, it's been looked at in combination, and it's been looked at in patients that don't even have a FLT3 ITD mutation. And it shows activity, clinical activity in all of those scenarios, such that we're hoping that that drug becomes available so that with a patient who fails induction therapy, has primary refractory disease, that we can actually use a single agent, orally available drug, the ASP2215, to try to get them into remission and then be able to move them to an allogeneic transplant.
In terms of the issue of the patients benefiting, quote, without the FLT3 rearrangement or mutations, could it be that there's some other aspect of FLT3 that maybe there's something abnormal about FLT3, but it's not a mutation?
Yeah, well, there are other forms of FLT3, other forms of mutated FLT3, including a point mutation, D835. It's in the activation domain region. It turns out it's not as important prognostically, but it can be active in these leukemias. And one of the things about ASP as a drug is it actually hits both the ITD mutation as well as the point mutation. So it's a little bit more broad. Now, we're looking at patients that don't have a FLT3 mutation. We know that there are other tyrosine kinases that are very important in these, and they include things like c-kit and EGFR and different receptors that probably there's benefit to targeting. We haven't done them quite as systematically as we have with FLT3, but yeah, these are broad drugs. They hit multiple targets, all of which may contribute in the right patient to some success, added success to therapy.
Globally, what fraction of patients with AML right now are thought to have FLT3 or, you know, even this high allelic FLT3?
Yeah, so the majority of the ITDs do have a high allelic ratio, but, you know, it's somewhere between 20 and 25% of all newcomer leukemias will have one of the forms of a FLT3 mutation.
So are you anticipating that midostaurin is going to become available? And if it is, are you going to use it?
I think everybody's quite excited about it. And I do think that having this large data, that if this drug becomes available for this indication, that it will be used and it will most likely replace sorafenib. You know, midostaurin is not a perfect drug either. It has toxicities associated with it as well. So we do have some work to do to refine our FLT3 inhibitors so we get better effects.
I think also the midostaurin study, I think, was for patients, you know, under age, I think it was 60. Is that the way you think it ought to be used?
Well, my suspicion is it will be applied more broadly. And again, it wasn't necessarily with kids and, you know, older. And we've done lots of smaller studies with sorafenib. You had made mention that a year before in ASH, we had the first insight that sorafenib following a transplant, patients did better. There have been studies by the German Cooperative Group suggesting that adding FLT3 inhibitor sorafenib to AML therapy maybe wasn't a great benefit to them. When they looked further at their data in the patients that went through transplant and they used it as a maintenance strategy following transplant, they actually did better. And so, in fact, that's why sorafenib is used pretty prominently.
Let's talk about MDS, and maybe you can begin by presenting your 68-year-old woman.
Yeah, so I've got an older school teacher, great health, but fatigue. A real common way patients present with MDS is with fatigue over a series of months, found with significant cytopenias, pancytopenias. All her bloodlines were down. And interestingly, her bone marrow cytogenetics revealed a deletion of chromosome 7, felt to be one of the sort of high-risk, very poor markers of MDS. It's interesting. This is one of those mutations that is often found when patients have other toxic exposures or other problems. Their bone marrow is coming out of another process, like previous treatment with chemotherapy, et cetera. She had none of that. She was actually pretty healthy. She was actually referred to us at the time point around her four cycles. So her primary team elected to treat her with a demethylating drug, 5-azacitidine, traditional schedule, 7 days a week, given every 1 week, every 28 days. And by four cycles, you could start to see that her counts seemed to be improving all across the board. And this is actually when we first met her. So the consultation coming to me is, hey, Doug, what do we do now?
So just to backtrack a little bit, you mentioned she got a 7-day course. And this is in the community. Was this 7 consecutive days or Monday through Friday, Monday, Tuesday?
Yeah, this was a 5 and 2. The weekend was given off because their infusion center couldn't do it on the weekends. And they did do it the following 2 days.
And just as a practical measure, how do you approach that issue? Do you prefer doing it 7 straight days? Do you ever do some people 5 days? Do you factor risk in?
Yeah, we do all of that. I agree with you. You know, the data that we have, the best data we have is 7 days in a row. So it's tough to look at it and say, hey, do something different. That being said, in the 68-year-old, what I'm thinking about when I would be treating this patient is I want to get a response because I know that these drugs aren't likely to work long term for patients, particularly high risk patients, but I want to get a response. And I think that you can trust 5 days of demethylating drugs, 2 days off, 2 days on of these drugs, or 7 days in a row to give you some data about response because we know that patients can respond to any of those schedules. So I was comfortable when the doc planned the schedule that they did, and many community physicians who really have good practices have developed ways to give these drugs successfully. And she responded, and that's one of the interesting things about this case to me is that it does sort of support the idea that getting a response is really important.
So she came to you for input about what to do at that point. What did you think?
Yeah, so our discussion really was around what I thought were two options. One is you could continue on the azacitidine. We know that these drugs need to be given continuously, and there are patients that are on them for years and years and years and do really, really well. That's one strategy. The second strategy is to move on to something that's more definitive. And what I mean by definitive is potentially curative, like an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Knowing the patient's health, knowing her tolerance of the drug, and knowing the fact that she was responding, I pictured her as really a very good candidate to consider an allogeneic stem cell transplant, knowing that it is potentially curative for patients with bone marrow diseases like AML or MDS, when they're responding well, seems to be the ideal time to try to move people to a stem cell transplant.
So what happened with her?
So she has just been discharged from our transplant unit, so it's very, very early. She's about 80 or 90 days from a non-ablative or a mini transplant. She had a donor in her daughter, so she had a partial match, half match donor, and she engrafted well. She's been slowly gaining her strength back. And she's had really good blood counts for the past almost 30 or 35 days. So we're now taking care of her in our regular clinic, and we'll soon be sharing responsibilities with her primary team that treated her.
What about lenalidomide in MDS, and particularly non-DEL5Q?
Yeah. Patients with non-DEL5Q MDS, lenalidomide has been studied, and it's actually pretty effective. Now, you have to weigh it, the balance it. So if I took a low-risk patient, primarily anemic, and said they need some transfusions once a month or once every 3 weeks, and I want to get rid of that, lenalidomide is a pretty good drug. About 25 or 30% of patients will have improvement of their hemoglobin and become transfusion independent on lenalidomide. Now, that sounds pretty good. It's a pill you take at home. It's relatively well tolerated. You have to be very careful of other cytopenias, but patients can manage the drug. I do put that juxtaposed to the studies done on demethylating drugs, which have a better likelihood of a low-risk patient becoming transfusion independent, but are much more cumbersome. And so we know the evolution of the demethylating drugs, which we didn't talk about earlier, but is really interesting, is now there's oral formulations of both decitabine and azacitidine. Each year at ASH and at ASCO, we're learning more about some studies that are being done. To date, we're still in the low numbers, 20s and 30s of numbers of patients. Again, we're not at a point where we've done lots of huge studies with these oral demethylating drugs. But what they've seen with some of the oral demethylating drugs, case reports, but really provocative, is the fact that when you inhibit methylation continually over time, that you can get patients who had lost their response to subcutaneous or IV drug, give them the oral formulation of it, and because you can get a different demethylating pattern by doing it more continually, 2 weeks in a row or 3 weeks in a row with a week or two off, that opens up the door to really better understanding of how these drugs work and really how we're going to use them moving forwards to be determined, but provocative stuff. So lenalidomide, I think, is a good drug worth considering in low-risk patients. Primarily anemia is the problem, and whether or not they have the DEL5Q or not, I think it's a reasonable drug to use, because if you're careful with it and it's well tolerated by your patient, they can give the drug to themselves at home and manage it pretty well.
What about other IMIDs in MDS, particularly pomalidomide?
Yeah, pomalidomide is one of the IMIDs that we know has a lot of activity in the immunologic space. Now, we don't always know how these drugs work, but it's kind of getting notoriety now for being prominent in the immunologic space. And again, it does have activity from everything we can tell in MDS. It hasn't been studied as formally as lenalidomide has been, obviously, but it is a drug that we do think has some promise. And I think lots of people believe that maybe pomalidomide in combination with some of the other agents, a demethylating drug, a histone deacetylase inhibitor, some other ways to target MDS may turn out to offer some pathways ahead for a lot of our patients.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about CML. And I see you've got a great case here, a 26-year-old woman.
Yeah, this is a really interesting case. And I'll be really truthful with you. The evolution of CML has been incredible in the last decade, as you know. And I don't see nearly the number of CML patients I used to, right? So Docs are really comfortable using these drugs in the community. So again, this is a patient who I did not see at diagnosis, but I had the pleasure of meeting her when she was coming up with a clinical challenge. So this is a 28-year-old, again, relatively healthy, annual exam, high white count of 18,000. So not that remarkable. What was interesting is her platelet count was elevated as well. She had some repeat testing that confirmed the elevated white count and high platelets. The docs did the right thing. They actually did a bone marrow test and found that she had a hypercellular marrow, and the cytogenetics confirmed their suspicious diagnosis of having the Philadelphia chromosome, giving her a diagnosis of chronic phase CML. again, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe almost 6 years now, but she was treated with imatinib as upfront therapy, 400 milligrams a day, and she actually did really well. She had a very sort of brisk response. In a few weeks, her counts had normalized. She was having a complete cytogenetic remission, so zero chromosomes positive by 6 months, which is a really nice response. And she began to show evidence of undetectability by the molecular PCR test as early as 12 months. So this is a really good responder very early to this drug, imatinib.
So before we go on to the question that she came to discuss with you, just to backtrack a little bit about where we are today in terms of upfront management of CML. So first of all, imatinib's generic.
It is. It's just been generic for a couple of months now.
And how is it shaking out in terms of price?
I think the next big price jump will be in another 6 or 9 months. And the reason is that there's only one group that's producing the generic version of the drug currently. This will be open to other groups of producers soon, which I think will be the big cost jump. So for right now, there has not been a huge change in the price, but there will be soon.
So I'm curious how you've been approaching the issue of upfront therapy and whether it's going to change if, as you say, we get to a point where there's a really huge difference in cost.
There are three drugs approved upfront for CML, imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib. They're all very, very effective. There's a few facts we know. One is that a second generation drug causes responses more quickly than imatinib. It causes responses to be deeper at each time point than imatinib. And these second generation drugs are associated with fewer, we'll call them transforming events, death, accelerated or blast crisis phase. So we know that those drugs do a better job upfront in those settings. What we also know is that there has not been a change or an improvement in overall survival based on using a second generation for a first generation drug. So we know that we're getting better responses quality-wise, but it's not translating yet into survival advantage. What this means to the practitioner is that each of these drugs is really fair game for upfront therapy. They work really, really well. There have been some retrospective looks at the phase 3 data that pitted nilotinib versus imatinib, as well as the phase 3 data pitting dasatinib against imatinib. And they've seen that where the biggest benefit in response rate and possibly survival happens is in the high-risk patients. So patients that present early with a sort of a high Sokal score or a high Hosford score, those patients seem to derive more benefit from starting a second-generation drug than a low-risk patient. So if I look back on the care that my 26-year-old patient had, I think it was really, really good care. She had pretty low-risk presentation. She was asymptomatic and did well. And imatinib was certainly a reasonable drug for her. She tolerates it well. It made perfect sense. If we flip this around and make this patient a high-risk presentation, super big spleen size, super high platelet count, patient with possibly B symptoms, weight loss, and feeling poorly for a few weeks before the diagnosis, I would suggest that in that class or that group of patients, I favor the second generation drugs up front because I think that's where we see the greatest amount of benefit that might translate into survival.
So your algorithm there, do you see that being affected by price?
I do. And I only know this from answering the phone calls from the insurance companies who are asking me to re-prescribe the drug and asking me to clarify, is it brand and medically necessary or can we use a generic? So those at the annual renewal of these prescriptions for my patients, I'm getting a lot of queries and wanting me to follow up in a different way. We want to believe that the generic formulations are going to be just as effective. It's quite likely they will be. We're lucky in CML that we have got a marker called the Philadelphia chromosome that we can measure. And if we have patients that are persistently at very, very, very low levels, and we switch to a generic formulation and we see something changing, we need to be able to collect those data moving forward so that we can really understand and be confident that patients are doing really, really well with the generic version.
That's amazing. You know, I feel like I've asked people a million times about the issue of generic imatinib, and this is the first time any investigator brought up the question of whether or not a generic would be as effective.
Well, let me just tell you, we've been treating people with thyroid medications for years. And we know that all thyroid medications aren't the same for a lot of reasons. Many patients do beautifully well. And the answer for thyroid medicine is that a generic drug may work as well as a brand name, but in fact, you may have to adjust the dose. It may not be absorbed as readily, and you might need a slightly higher dose with the generic form. And we've been able to do that. We don't quite have that luxury with our TKIs. There are certainly multiple different doses, but if a patient wasn't absorbing the generic form of the drug very well, that may change what their response looks like moving forward. So I think it behooves us to be mindful. And I'm not at all suggesting that we can't use generic drugs. I just want us to be mindful and thoughtful of how we monitor people when we make the change to a generic from a brand name drug.
That's really fascinating. I never thought about the idea of absorption. You would think that the chemical itself, that should be pretty straightforward. But again, the absorption, that's very interesting.
And again, this little vignette may or may not make sense. But one of the interesting things that came out at ASH in the last couple of years is this idea of compliance. And there's been some really nice studies looking at compliance on clinical trials. And early on with treatment, compliance of less than 90% compared to those patients who comply more than 90% of their dosing has a very different outcome. The likelihood of getting a good response is lower. And in some studies, there's been a hint that maybe survival is affected. If you think of 90% of doses in a month for patients with imatinib, that's missing three doses, right? So if you miss more than three doses, you're less than 90% compliant, your response rate changes. Let's translate that to a drug that's absorbed 80% as effectively as another drug. And you say to yourself, geez, what would my compliance be like there? And so I really believe that we do need to monitor PCRs carefully, and small fluctuations are accepted across the board, no problem. But if we see trends in our patients where their responses don't feel as deep or as stable on generics, we're probably going to have to further investigate that.
That is really fascinating. I see you have the paper here in Current Medical Research and Opinion, something I don't usually read. Treatment patterns, overall survival, healthcare resource use, and costs in elderly Medicare beneficiaries with CML using second-generation TKIs. What did you look at there?
So really interesting. Thanks for finding that, because it is in a little bit of a sort of an outcomes-based research journal. You know, I worked with several investigators from Harvard, very interested in looking at retrospective data. So we looked at Medicare database of elderly patients. Interestingly, you know, the median age of patients diagnosed with CML is about 55 or so. And it turns out that we have very, very, very few studies prospectively looking at how older patients do, although it makes up nearly half the population of patients being treated with TKIs. So we went back and retrospectively looked at how patients did when they were treated with a second-line therapy. So it was patients that had been treated with imatinib and then went on to either nilotinib or dasatinib. And we actually found out that elderly patients, there seemed to be a survival benefit for patients started on nilotinib compared to patients started on dasatinib. And what was really, really interesting in this study was that when we looked at the doses prescribed by practitioners out there, that neither the dasatinib nor the nilotinib group was dosed according to the package insert. You know, we don't have any guidelines. How do you dose an 85-year-old? How do you dose an 80-year-old? Well, it turns out that physicians naturally use their instinct to lower the dose in older patients.
Wow.
And they were getting responses such that patients started on nilotinib were far less likely to progress, far less likely to have to change the dose, and far less likely to have to stop the drug compared to patients started on dasatinib. This translated into retrospectively, it translated into a survival advantage for patients being started on nilotinib. I think this is provocative because we have to study these drugs in patients that are older, so we can really make sure we're dosing them appropriately and we're giving them the best treatment possible.
That is really interesting. How do you go about choosing, if you have a higher risk patient or for whatever reason you're going to use a second generation TKI, how do you choose between the two?
That's a great question, and one that's maybe the most common question asked to me for primary docs that aren't going to necessarily send me the patient, but they want some advice. I fall back on the toxicity profile of each of the TKIs is a little bit unique and distinctive. So we really think about the toxicity profile. There's one other caveat, and that is that patients treated with nilotinib, very good drug, very effective, you have to be willing to take it twice a day, have to be willing to take it on an empty stomach. So that may not fit into everybody's lifestyle. But for the most part, I don't have a strong opinion that one's better than the other in first line setting. But if toxicity profiles, things like blood sugar, so nilotinib is pretty famous for causing people with borderline diabetes to have to kick over and to have to manage their blood sugars aggressively. There's concerns of cardiac toxicities with the drug nilotinib as well as the drug ponatinib. You know, dasatinib has a lot of cytopenias, some platelet dysfunction, and the possibility of developing an effusion, like a pleural effusion, pericardial effusion associated with it. So again, there are slightly different toxicity patterns that one has to note before picking a drug for the patient.
I want to finish out with this discussion of CML by talking about the reason this woman came to see you. And I've already got an internal bet with myself about what you did, but let's see if I know you well enough. So why did she come and see you?
Yeah, so she had been undetectable for several years in a row, and it was a young woman and really was thinking about family planning. She was really wanting to start a family, and she basically came here and said, hey, you know, what's my possibility of being able to stop this drug, and what's the possibility of being able to carry a pregnancy and have the pregnancy be as safe as possible? None of the TKIs is approved or recommended to be given during pregnancy. They're really not even recommended for men on them to impregnate someone. So, you know, these are complicated drugs, and we want to make sure we're really careful.
Could I just ask, because I've heard that thing about the men mentioned, I mean, do you advise your men not to impregnate a woman?
I do. I realize that's not practical. And there are now many, many reports of healthy pregnancies, although the husband or the father of the baby was on a TKI throughout the whole process. So it's tough for me to make a strong recommendation knowing that the FDA does have a warning associated with these drugs, but there's now more data that suggests that the risks seem to be really, really small if the man has CML in that.
So I know you're a very conservative, cautious doc, but I'm very curious to know what you recommended this lady.
Well, what I recommended for this woman compared to what I would have recommended 5 or 6 years ago, there's now data. There's about 7 studies or 8 studies now that show that stopping is a possibility for some subset of patients. The criteria almost universally used were that patients had to maintain an undetectable state by PCR for at least 2 years in a row. These were adults. They had to be treated with a drug for at least 3 years, et cetera, et cetera. But the main thing is stability of undetectability for some period of time, 2 years being a common length of time. I looked back at her PCRs. They were done by reputable labs. She had been undetectable. She had a really brisk, good response. You know, she became undetectable as early as a year. You know, may have even been 9 months, but it was for sure by a year. And so I said to her, listen, there's the possibility that you could stop the drug and remain off the drug for several years without evidence that your disease has returned. I believe in my heart that most people still have some level of disease in their body, but they're just able to maintain it at such a low level that they can't be detected by molecular testing. So she felt really strongly, and I suggested that there are data to support stopping, but I suggested very strongly that she would need very, very careful monitoring. And what I've done with other patients in this setting is that if they've shown evidence of disease progression or reemergence of their CML, that in fact I prescribed interferon to help stabilize the CML to carry the pregnancy through with the plans of moving back to the TKI once that has happened.
But you only do that if they relapse.
Yeah, I did not necessarily add it in until we sort of see how patients tolerate the pregnancy in general and to see if they're really successful at becoming pregnant.
You know, I was just thinking, again, I've asked a lot of people this over the years. What about the idea? Am I correct in saying that if you're going to relapse after stopping, it usually is within 6 months?
Yeah, that's been what all the observations for all the stopping studies have been. The biggest slope on the curve is within 6 months.
So how about just stopping and watching them for 6 months, and then if they're stable, you know, saying, okay, get pregnant or try to get pregnant?
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable strategy. I suggested about 3 months for her to double. We check PCRs monthly for 2 or 3 months. then every other month for ongoing for these patients. And the reason I suggested three, I sort of made it up. But the idea was that would clearly give her some time to get her imatinib out of the system and give her a chance to sort of normalize her ovulation, et cetera. And all of this was taken into consideration.
So what's her current situation?
Her current situation is that she is 4 or 5 months pregnant currently.
Wow.
She has remained undetectable. She is not on a TKI. And again, I'm very cautious in saying this because I don't think folks would believe this is a standard of care, but she gets PCR testing done every 2 months currently. The biggest question internally for me at this point is at 7 or 8 months of her pregnancy, if she would show positivity at that point, you know, what would be the safety factor of just starting a TKI at that point? And in fact, we don't know the data, but that would be something that would be rustling in my head. I think being conservative and already sort of stretching the limits of what our data support us for is I would probably use interferon for a month or two. Hopefully she'll deliver a healthy child. And then we would talk about moving back on to the TKIs. It should be noted that TKIs do come through breast milk. So for what it's worth, you know, we wouldn't, again, it's not recommended that people breastfeed while on TKIs either.
This is her first pregnancy?
This is her first pregnancy.
Wow, what a story. Incredible.
And, you know, I've got a, for what it's worth, I've got a series of maybe 7 or 8 or so patients who have some iteration of this where they've been able to carry successful pregnancies. And I'm not saying at all that I know what I'm doing, but I'm very cautious and following them very, very carefully. And I really do my best to make sure they really understand the implications of all of it, specifically the implications of their disease changing. And so it is an area of ongoing interest for lots of young women and young families.
How do you respond to a patient like this who just wants to stop, period? Any patient who wants to stop, you know, they don't like taking the drug. Nobody likes taking drugs. Maybe they have side effects. Maybe they're very, very well informed and go, you know, I know there's a risk, but I want to take a shot. Maybe I'm cured.
Yeah, this is a hard question. I love the fact that we're getting more and more data. I do encourage all of my patients to consider participating in a trial if they're talking about stopping it, because I think collecting those data are really important for the long-term understanding of what stopping means and what will happen to patients who are stopping. But I have been faced with the exact scenario that you've asked. I've been faced with the scenario where they've come right out and said, hey, doc, I really want to stop. What are my criteria? What are my goals? And I've had some people that have actually stopped it and not told me. Arrived for their appointment. We were thinking all was well. They were undetectable. And it was only after they had that first undetectable off drug that they came back and said, hey, Doug, I want you to know that I wasn't completely honest with you, but I read all the papers. I really wanted to stop it. I knew you weren't going to strongly encourage me, but I wanted to give it a try. I've supported those patients, but I've worked really hard to be sure that they understand the limits of the data. The problem with all the stopping studies is very simple. There's just not a lot of patients. These are 50 patient and 100 and 120 patient studies. These are not 800 patient studies where we really can say to ourselves, this is a practice that's reasonable to consider for certain patients.
Do you think there are patients? You said you felt like a lot of patients might have the disease, we can't just detect it. Do you think, though, that we are curing people with CML, with TKIs?
I'd love to think we are. I think there are two schools of thought out there. Some really, really smart CML docs and colleagues of mine are pretty convinced that CML is never completely eliminated from you. I sort of trust their thinking. What we do know is that there are patients from the interferon day. So we have patients that have been treated with interferon for 10 years, undetectable by the best test at that time, stop the drug, and have remained undetectable for another 10 years. But intermittently, a super sophisticated, super sensitive PCR test will be able to find the Philadelphic marker in some of these patients. And we just don't really know if we can ever completely get rid of it or not. There is some thought that those patients really diagnosed early in their CML, so-called sort of early chronic phase CML, seem to do better long-term with some of the stopping things compared to those that have probably had a bit more advanced disease at the time of their diagnosis. So from my perspective, this woman, again, my patient sort of rolled into this. We probably discovered it early. She responded really well. She was undetectable for several years, even a couple years beyond what studies required. And she really had a goal in mind, which was pregnancy. And again, the discussion that we're going to have at hopefully another 6 or 8 months is, hey, do you go back on the TKI now? Or you've been off the drug. We'll say, well, she'll be off the drug for about a year or a year and a couple months once the baby's delivered. The question really will be, do you want to keep going every 2 months with testing and see how long this goes? Or do you want to be safe and go back on the drug? These will become really critical as we learn more and more about the long-term side effects and implications of TKI use. So as you mentioned with your discussions with Dan George, you know, there are side effects, chronic side effects of using inhibitors, even though they seem pretty benign, there are some long-term problems. So if we can really cure people, that's great.
The last thing I want to ask you about is MPN, and I didn't ask you to present any cases, but I want to just chat with you because we had a really wild day. We had Ruben Mesa. We did a program with him where he spent the entire day seeing MPN patients in the practice of two docs, and it's a program, and it just really is ringing in my head. They saw about 12 patients. He went through everything, but I just want to kind of get your take on what some of the major issues are that have affected the care of patients with myelofibrosis, but also P. Vera and ET.
Yeah, these are really, a lot of respect for Ruben, really, really good at what he does. And he sees a lot of patients with these diseases. And I think that some of the challenges for the MPDs is they're really rare. And most primary oncologists, hematologists probably won't have anybody in their clinic and maybe a couple. And to really, you know, these diseases really, I believe, require a lot of finesse because each disease itself is a spectrum, and for each of these diseases, basic supportive care like checking blood counts regularly is all a lot of people need. Or maybe with P. vera, somebody will need some phlebotomy periodically, but they may not need big medical interventions. And on the other hand, in these high-risk disease or evolving, progressing diseases, these proliferative diseases turning into leukemia, that carries one of the very, very, very poor prognosis. And obviously, we're looking for ways to identify patients who are likely to progress. We're looking for ways to minimize the impact of the proliferative disorder on the blood counts and how the patient feels. And we're looking for ways to slow down any of those processes of progression or the disease getting worse. The patients I see, and probably Dr. Mesa as well, are ones that primary docs have been following for a while. Something's changing. They're needing transfusions now. They're having symptomatic organomegaly, like splenomegaly, for example. And ultimately, they get referred to us for thoughts on what to do. We've got a couple of markers. We've got the Philadelphia marker, right? So anybody with an MPD suspicious, you should always rule out that they have CML, because the truth is that makes your life easy. We've got really good drugs to treat them. We've got JAK2 as a marker. So we've got marker of these disorders, these proliferative disorders, maybe JAK2 positive, which gives us a drug to help us with symptoms and maybe a drug or a couple of drugs that will help us prolong survival or increase survival in these patients. So knowing and understanding the status of the JAK2 mutations as well as the status of the Philadelphia markers are vital for anybody that you're treating with these diseases. My big struggle in taking care of these patients is really when to intervene. And that's the question we're all struggling with as clinicians. And I've used blood counts, I've used performance status and symptomatic splenomegaly or the development of symptomatic splenomegaly. And I've used a third criteria, which has been written about in lots of papers, but maybe some people don't view it as a formal criteria. But that is the evolution of peripheral blood blasts. So when patients start to have these diseases and have cytopenias, they think they can be tracked and followed pretty carefully. When they start to have disease where they're symptomatic from the disease and they start to show peripheral blasts, that makes me more anxious that their disease is really evolving and we need to do some sort of significant intervention because these patients really begin to carry a poor prognosis when we start to see those markers.
One thing that came up in one of the patients that I hadn't heard about, I'm curious whether you have any experience with, was a patient who had a fantastic response with MF to ruxolitinib, but developed herpes zoster. What's the issue there?
Yeah, I think one of the recommendations out there is whether people should have shingles vaccines prior to getting this therapy. And that is a recommendation now that if there's time, the patient should be vaccinated with shingles vaccine because they are at increased risk for the reemergence of a herpes zoster infection when people are on these JAK2 inhibitors.
What about other JAK inhibitors?
The question out there from the biology is which JAKs are the ones we need to inhibit, which ones are proliferative, which ones help suppress normal hematopoiesis. And so the effort to really study the biology is to, can we isolate the JAK2 versus the JAK1 inhibition, and what kind of results do we see? Currently, you know, there is some discussion that maybe inhibiting two might be too toxic, or maybe we need to save those for more aggressive cases of the disease. I mean, we certainly know the best that JAK2 inhibition should shrink spleens and can get rid of lots of side effects, itchiness and skin rashes and sometimes fatigue and B symptoms. So there can be a lot of quality of life improvements with JAK2 inhibition. It does cause lowering of blood counts, predictable lowering of blood counts. The platelets drop 20 or 30,000. You can sort of understand what you're sort of getting into there. But it doesn't necessarily fix all the blood count abnormalities. It doesn't necessarily improve the anemia that you see. And certainly, there's not been great studies to suggest that it alters the fibrosis pattern for a lot of patients. So again, symptomatic control are where we are with these. Question is, can JAK1 do better? Can combinations do better? Do you need to think about bringing in another type of TKI to sort of help with that? One of the interesting combinations people talk about is the use, particularly for fibrosis, is lenalidomide has some activity in fibrosis, and it has some activity like it does in MDS, that it can improve red cell counts. So it can improve the anemia that's seen in some of these diseases. Question is, are there combinations that would be tolerable of those drugs that might be more effective in some of our patients long-term? To be determined.